Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
It's only a kick. A jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. My name is George Scott, the editor-in-chief of Bike Radar, joined today by Liam, our presenter for all things road and gravel over on YouTube, and Simon from Bromley, senior technical writer on BikeRadar.com. Liam, I'll start with you. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. I consumed many beers yesterday watching Paris-Roubaix, and I just had my best day. I was living my best life.
Excellent. And Simon, you've just back from a week off. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Yeah, I didn't consume that many beers yesterday because I'm a saint, but I did enjoy the coverage of the race.
Excellent. Well, you both alluded to what we're going to chat about in today's podcast. It is the morning after the night before. It's 9:30 in our podcast dungeon. Liam is sipping a coffee, getting ready to chat about all things tech at Paris-Roubaix 2024. We're going to run through the hottest tech trends from this year's race. So we're going to dive straight into it. Let's start with tyres, because tyres are always a key talking point at Paris-Roubaix. Liam, what was the story with tyres at yesterday's race?
So cast your mind back to last year. Van der Poel turned up in the Velodrome and won on 32mm tyres. And basically this year, everyone took a look at him and thought, that looked like it worked. So everyone copied his homework, and pretty much everyone was on 32mm tubeless tyres. I don't really think I saw many tubulars. I think Cofidis were the only team running tubs in the men's race. Yeah, it seems that the tide really has turned.
I think Mads Pedersen from Little Trek may have been on tubs. He was at Flanders. I think that's a personal preference choice for him. But yeah, the rest of the Little Trek team were on tubeless tyres. And actually, I think their Pirelli tyres, especially, according to some reports, measured, they were running 32s, but they measured up almost sort of 34mm on the kind of wider Trek or Bontrager rims. So yeah, big tyres at this year's race.
And it was a big split between two tyre brands. So you had the likes of Movistar, FDJ, UAE, Ineos, all on Continental's GP5000S TR tyres. You then had Intermarché on the AS TR version.
I think Bahrain also ran those.
And slightly grippier, aren't they?
I believe Fred Wright might have been running 35C tyres, which I'm surprised fit in his Merida Reacto aero bike, to be quite honest. But there you go.
And then the other big tyre was Vittoria's Corsa Pro. You had Alpecin, DSM, EF, Arkea, Visma, just some of the teams that are on that tyre. And a smattering of riders chose the control version of the Corsa Pro. Simon, you've tested these.
Yeah, so I tested the standard Corsa Pro, and our colleague Ashley Quinlan has tested the kind of control version. Now, I think the Corsa Pro tyre is basically the kind of the faster all-round racing one, and the control version, it is the one that, you know, Vittoria would designate as, you know, better for cobbled races like this because it's slightly heavier, slightly grippier tread. But I think by kind of all accounts, a slightly less faster tyre, and I'm guessing that people just wanted those couple of extra watts.
Have we seen a bit of convergence now at Paris-Roubaix when it comes to tyre choice, both in terms of the fact that everyone, or certainly the vast majority, are running tubeless rather than tubular, but also that move from some teams on 28s or 30s in recent years, but pretty much everyone on 32s this year?
I think so. I think the kind of trend that, as far as I'm seeing it, is that teams are essentially maxing out the clearance of their aero road bikes. So where we saw like the team Lotto running, or Bayer's Orca aero bikes, for example, they tended to be running slightly smaller tyres because that bike has a max clearance of 30 millimetres. But teams whose bikes could accommodate bigger tyres basically seem to max out their tyre clearance.
Well, tyres are always a big talking point at Paris-Roubaix. So let's move on to tyre pressure before we start to delve into some of the other topics we've got on the agenda today, including hookless, massive chain rings, the fact that aero bikes are dominating again, and much more, including gravel bikes, actually. That's a really interesting talking point from this year's race. But let's move on to tyre pressure, a closely guarded secret. But you do have some information here, Liam, as to what Mathieu van der Poel was running.
Yeah, old Cycling News were at the race and they videoed his tyres being pumped up to 3.46 bar, which is 52 psi. And he is listed on Pro Cycling Stats as being 75 kilos. That may not be accurate, but that's a very low tyre pressure for what you would consider is a larger rider.
Yeah, certainly. And an extremely low tyre pressure for a kind of, you know, world tour professional. We know we're quite used to, you know, hearing riders talking about pumping up their tyres to kind of like 100 PSI. Now, that is obviously probably a minority of riders and, you know, away from Paris-Roubaix, but it is still seriously low. And to be honest, I'm quite surprised that the AlphaSyndiKernik mechanics allowed anyone to film that, because you would have thought that's kind of carefully guarded information, but maybe they were just so confident that it wouldn't really matter if anyone else copied what van der Poel were doing.
Simon, you did some testing on tyre pressure a couple of years ago. Was it 32 millimetre tyres or 30s that you were looking at?
I believe it was, yeah, 28s and 32s.
Is there anything that our listeners should be taking from the fact that Mathieu van der Poel is running 52 PSI?
Yeah, I think if you're riding on rough roads, lower pressures tend to be faster. And obviously, you know, with a race such as Paris-Roubaix, there is a lot of rough roads, but there is also a lot of tarmac. So there is a kind of balancing act between the perfect pressure for the cobbles is probably lower than 52 PSI, but the perfect pressure for the tarmac sections is probably slightly higher. So you've got to kind of consider where you're riding. But certainly, if you're moving up to a wider tyre, you should drop your tyre pressures in tandem with that move, because otherwise your kind of casing tension is going to be higher for the same pressure in that bigger tyre. So yeah, definitely, if you're still running 90 PSI in a kind of 28 mil tyre, your tyre pressures are likely too high.
I think I've got to reduce my tyre pressures. I've gone to 30 millimetre GP5000T, what are they? STR. And I'm still running 55 PSI. And if I need to be like van der Poel...
You've been working out though, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been training.
Well, van der Poel came through this year's race and last year's race, back-to-back wins, with no flats. I think even if he got a flat this year, he could have got off the bike, waited for his mechanic, had an espresso, had the tyre change, and then got back on and won the race. But clearly, Mathieu van der Poel is doing something right. So let's move on to hookless. This could be a whole podcast in itself. We've done podcasts on hookless in the past. I'm sure we will do podcasts on hookless rims in the future. However, just to set the scene, Simon, this has been a key talking point in recent weeks and months. So what's the story with hookless in the Pro Peloton at the moment?
So there've been a couple of kind of high profile failures. Most obviously, Thomas de Gendt had a kind of crash at the UAE Tour where he hit an object, it turned out, and his rim broke, and the tyre and insert dismounted from the rim, causing him to crash. Now, at the time, it wasn't clear if he had hit an object, and a lot of people kind of jumped to conclusions that it was just the tyre had just, you know, suddenly blown off the rim for no reason. And, you know, perhaps they were running a kind of unsafe combination, because obviously, if you're running hookless rims, you must use tubeless tyres. And there are kind of ETRTO and ISO international standards around what tyre sizes can be used on what rims. So there was a lot of speculation about this. And yeah, at last year's race, we saw kind of quite a few people breaking wheels and tyres dismounting from the rims. You know, I think the kind of problem with this is it's kind of not clear whether the cause is the fact that the rims are hookless or that they were hooked, or whether, you know, if a rider smashes into a 5 centimetre cobble at 80 kilometres per hour, you know, can any carbon wheel withstand that? So, but then, yeah, in this year's race, we didn't really see any issues as far as I'm aware.
Such a non-story. And I'm glad it was a non-story because, you know, I would prefer that the industry is sensible about this and it works to improve the safety standards and the clarity of information to consumers and teams as well about what tyre sizes that they can run on their rims. But yeah, we saw no real massive crashes because of tyres.
Yeah, and I think the kind of as a result of that incident with De Gendt, Zip, who supplied De Gendt's team, is now recommending that its riders only use 30mm tyres on the specific rims that De Gendt was using when he was actually using 28mm tyres when that incident happened. I think it's kind of like that wasn't a cause of the incident, but the ISO and ETRTO standards were updated to suggest that what was previously allowed is now no longer allowed. And so it's kind of a complicated situation. But hopefully, as you say, there weren't any issues in this race. And hopefully this kind of story, we're going to go back to, because I feel like hookless had kind of settled down a bit and this sort of looked like it was about to rear its head again. But hopefully this kind of means it, you know, we can kind of rest easily and keep using our hookless rims.
Well, that's a topic we can delve into in a future podcast, just to clarify what the current safety standards are and if there is anything you need to look out for as a rider. But luckily no major incidents in Paris-Bay over the weekend. Liam, actually I missed the entrance to the Arenberg sector yesterday. How did the chicane unfold?
Again, non-story, but mostly because I think Alpecin had really shredded the race going into it. Obviously the women's race doesn't get to Arenberg. They enter the cobble sectors kind of ahead of that point. The men's race had been completely shredded. There were like 35 riders in that group. And you go into that kind of, let's not call it a chicane, let's call it a U-turn. It was really dead. Yeah, Alpecin had shredded it. You got 35 riders. It's relatively safe. If you come into that point with 100 riders, knowing that if you start Arenberg in less than P30, your race is over, I think you've got a different story.
Well, let's move on from our two non-stories, which is the chicane and hookless. And I love this next one. So massive chain rings. We're used to seeing big chain rings at Paris-Roubaix. The course is, I think often it's described as pan flat. It's not pan flat. There's some rolling terrain, a very lightly rolling terrain over the course of the first 100K or so. But it's, you know, in terms of pro races, it is effectively a flat race. So we always see big chain rings, big inner chain rings as well. So Ben Turner of Ineos was running a 62 chain ring, but he wasn't the biggest chain ring rider on the Ineos team, was he, Liam?
No, Josh Tarling, young Welshman, turned up with a 62 tooth, and my knees are weeping, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of, you know, we saw a lot of big chain rings. Yeah, obviously, Matthew van der Poel was only running a 54.
How did he win?
It's unbelievable. He must have very high cadence.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we've kind of seen this trend in recent months and even in recent years, really. It's kind of been ported over from time trialing. You know, I think it's worth pointing out that having a massive chain ring doesn't mean you're necessarily using a bigger gear, because obviously you can just shift up a couple of cogs at the back. A lot of this is about efficiency. And when there aren't any major climbs, you know, a lot of teams were running one by, even, you know, Josh Tarling, I believe, was running one by, and he's a Shimano sponsored rider who, you know, Shimano doesn't officially support one by for the road. When you've got a kind of wide-ranging 11 to 30 or 11 to 34 cassette out back, it's just you don't need a smaller chain ring. And especially with the speed that they were going yesterday, I believe it's the fastest ever Paris-Roubaix because they had a massive tailwind. I was reading the excellent blog Inner Ring this morning, and the race covered 54.7 kilometres in the first hour, which is faster than Bradley Wiggins's hour record. So, you know, it's just that kind of thing, like this kind of speed that the World Tour Peloton is racing at these days, you know, because of things like better tires, aero bikes, skin suits, you know, rider positions and, you know, kind of fueling and training and things like that. Yeah, it's kind of no surprise to see that on a kind of mainly flat race such as Paris-Roubaix, chain rings are getting pretty big.
Interestingly for me, taking a look at the women's race, for the first few editions of that race, we saw relatively standard chain ring setups. The SRAM riders would go to one by. But this year, I saw a few more riders kind of pushing to those bigger gears that we generally saw reserved for the men's peloton. So Lily Williams of the Human Powered Health Team has a double SRAM setup with 54 tooth outer, which is pretty stonking when you think that they've got a 10 tooth in the cassette.
Yeah, that's a really big gear. And I think, it just follows that the trends with the men's races, that the women's races just at every kind of level are just getting faster and faster.
Well, that's certainly a trend we've seen over Paris-Roubaix, since Matt Heyman's 2016 win on the Scott Foyle. A bit of a breakthrough moment for Heyman to win on the Foyle, an aero bike with 28mm tyres, as they were at the time, carbon wheels. You know, that was certainly the era when endurance bikes were still in the mix at Paris-Roubaix. I think the specialised Roubaix won the 2017 and the 2019 editions. After that, however, aero bikes now dominate at Paris-Roubaix. Was there a single endurance bike at this year's race? I don't think the Roubaix was raced at all.
I didn't see any specialised riders using the Roubaix, which is a real turning point because, you know, you had so many of their riders that would just use it. And this is a bike that was named after this race, but every specialised rider that I saw was using the Tarmac SL8.
So I believe in the women's race, Elisa Balsamo ran a Trek Domane.
She did.
And a few of her teammates did as well. I just want to give a shout out to Ellen van Dijk, who rode an absolutely incredible race. And I can't believe how well she's riding, having recently had a baby. You know, what an athlete. But as you say, George, aero bikes absolutely dominated. And, you know, no surprise with the kind of, with the speeds they're riding, the kind of this year's edition averaged like just over 47 kilometers per hour. And everyone was aero-optimized, aero helmets, skin suits. I think, you know, most of the peloton were also wearing time trial overshoes and things like that. So, you know, in the past, aero bikes tended to have narrower clearances, but that's just not the case anymore, really. As you say, you know, the specialized sponsored riders who weren't using the Roubaix, their Tarmac has clearance for 32mm tyres, and possibly you could squeeze in a bit more. And so that's what they went for.
Paris-Roubaix used to be an absolute nightmare for team mechanics. I'm sure it still is a nightmare. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of discussion about tyre choice and tyre pressure and so on. But they must be extremely grateful that they're not having to swap out a whole team's worth of bikes. And all of the kind of little odds and ends that often came with those bikes, like crosstop brakes, for example. Like, it's a pretty simple race now as far as the mechanics are concerned.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, Paris-Roubaix used to be the kind of like the dreamland for finding little hacks from pro riders and individual little things that every single rider wanted something special on their bike because they thought it was going to help them navigate the cobbles a bit better. But now everyone just seems to be running team issue bikes with slightly bigger tyres and maybe some tyre inserts.
Well, that's a very neat segue into the one team that weren't riding their regular team issue bike or didn't switch to an endurance bike, as the case with the Trek D'Amano and Marianne Vos on the Cervelo Soloist. But this is back to the men's race, and it was the Israel Premier Tech team who switched from the Factor Ostro Vam to the Factor Ostro Gravel. Now, this is the first time we've seen what is described as a gravel bike at Paris-Roubaix. They didn't really feature in the race, Liam, but can you speculate as to why they used this bike?
I think they did probably all of their testing on quite wet and muddy cobbles. The photos from the recons were of riders just plastered in mud. And then we saw Lotta Kopecky arrive into the velodrome of the women's race in a very clean white skin suit. There just wasn't really a problem with mud this year. And I think maybe the Israel Premier Tech team had kind of planned for it to be muddier.
It has been exceptionally wet this winter. So I think that was not a bad shout. I think also the reason that Israel Premier Tech would have chosen to run a gravel bike rather than a road bike is that for them, it's not such a big compromise. You know, if you look at the Ostro Gravel, it is essentially the Ostro Vam with bigger tyre clearances and a slightly longer wheelbase. And so for them to choose between those two, there's not really the big compromise as there would be for someone like, say, Van der Poel, if he hadn't run the Air Road and had run Canyon's gravel bike, which is, the name escapes me right now.
There's the Grizzle and the Grail, but neither would be suitable for Van der Poel at Paris-Roubaix.
No, so the Grail is more like a kind of wider tyre clearance version of the Canyon Ultimate, which is just not as aero, and it uses a kind of, you know, a wider handlebar, a taller head tube, all of these things. And this, you know, the same for specialised sponsored riders, for example. Those gravel bikes are far less aerodynamic than the Tarmac. And so whilst I'm sure there would have been some riders who maybe would have wished for a bit more tyre clearance on their aero bikes, we have to remember that the majority of the race actually takes place on tarmac. And so it's kind of like I said earlier, a lot of teams just seem to max out their tyre clearance on their aero road bike. But if we had a BMC-sponsored team in this race, maybe we'd have seen someone on the Caius, for example.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what size tyre the Israel Premier Tech team used? Was it still 32s?
Yeah, they were on 32s.
Do you think that, I mean, Simon, you made the point earlier that most teams are maxing out their clearance. Clearly, Israel Premier Tech weren't maxing out their clearance because the Ostro Gravel has clearance up to 45mm. However, having said that, if, say, the next crop of aero road bikes jump up to 35mm clearance, Do you think the tyre size will go with it at Paris-Roubaix?
So I think it depends on what your sponsors make. So I believe, as far as I'm aware, the GP5000 STR is only made up to a 32 mil. So perhaps if it had been available in a wider size, maybe they would have gone wider. There's also the case that, you know, these riders and teams are thinking about matching tyres to wheels as well. And so, you know, their kind of Factor, Israel Premier Tech team uses black ink wheels, which are from Factor. And it may be that their performance directors advised them that 32 mil was the kind of most that these wheel sets were really designed to kind of work with, you know, from a kind of aerodynamics perspective, that was the best balance. But if there were wider wheels, wider tyres available from the tyre sponsors, then yeah, maybe those questions would come into play, because we have seen tyre sizes, as you said, George, you know, we've grown from kind of 28 up to 32 in only a kind of, you know, a few short years. And so is the trend stopping here? Yeah, I'd be pretty surprised. Like I said earlier, Fred Wright was running 35 millimeter Continental GP5000 ASTRs. Now, that's a slightly heavier, slower tyre, but if Continental made the STR in a 35, would we have seen more teams running it if it could fit it in their bikes? You know, very possibly.
The move to disc brakes and the effect of that on Paris-Roubaix Tech cannot be overstated. Tyre clearance was the reason why Paris-Roubaix Tech used to be so complicated for so many reasons, with riders switching to endurance bikes or switching to cyclocross bikes with the additional clearance and cantilever brakes. But if you can get a 32mm tyre in your aero bike, then why wouldn't you run it? You can get so much comfort from that. And actually, that does lead on to the next point, where we don't necessarily see so much of the kind of like the little mechanic hacks and the really extreme kind of like multiple wraps of bar tape that we used to at Paris-Roubaix. However, there are still some riders that go for that, Liam.
Yeah, I think we saw plenty of double wrapped tape, but for me, the standout bar tape highlight, which really is getting quite niche, was ProLogo brought out One Touch 3D tape, which is like...
This stuff gives me the heebie-jeebies. I don't like the look of it.
I really want to get this in. It's if you took kind of a honeycomb texture and raised it off the tape. That is almost how I can describe it.
They've had it on their saddles, but ProLogo's had it on saddles before and gloves, right?
It's the CPC tech, if anyone's familiar with that. But yeah, it's kind of like a little volcanic kind of like 3D printed thing.
I can imagine it wears out quite quickly, because the saddles do look like they age relatively quickly to me. But yeah, Alison Jackson, last year's women's winner, she had it on her Cannondale Super 6, and a bunch of other ProLogo athletes had it as well. But yeah, apart from that, we saw a lot of double wrapped bars. Apart from Van der Poel, he just went, you know, one layer of tape because he's hard.
And no gloves?
No glove. God.
Single wrap of tape and no gloves for Mattia Van der Poel, but big plush tyres.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So even if things are a little bit more comfortable at Paris-Roubaix these days with the big tyres, the cobbles still are as harsh as ever. They certainly haven't changed. And there are a few things that teams need to do to keep the components attached to the bike. But that's not always the case, Liam, because we saw a few bike computers disappearing off into the roadside.
I mean, forget bike computers. Lotta Kopecky nearly lost her whole front end. She was borrowing an Allen key in between sectors just to tighten up her bars after they slipped on like an early cobble sector. Loads of riders then, yeah, they'll have their mechanics kind of put some fluffy tape or carpet tape, we call it gaffer tape here, just in their computer mount, just to stop the computers from flying off. And, you know, your computer, even if it is kind of taped in, will fly off in the event of a crash if it's hit. So a lot of riders were using the little dongles that come from Garmin. Yeah, it didn't work for everyone. Bless him, Sam Welsford. I saw him on Twitter last night asking for his hammerhead back. apparently, it's on sector 1 to 5. Somewhere. If you see it, get in touch.
I think someone's going to find that in their potatoes for next year after it's disappeared into a farmer's field. I mean, some of the old tricks, the old hacks, you know, absolutely have stood the test of time here. So yeah, seeing that kind of like skateboard tape and grip tape to keep bottles in place, you know, that is still the best way to keep your bottle in place at Paris-Roubaix. Although are teams using the kind of the old metal like elite cages where you can bend them in anymore? Is that still a thing?
We did see Pfeiffer Georgie, who finished on the podium of the women's race. She had a brand new, very modern Scott Foyle aero bike finished with a pair of good old fashioned elite metal bottle cages. And as you say, you can kind of like bend the cage in a little bit to give a slightly firmer grip. You know, I don't know if that's kind of completely necessary these days. There are plenty of modern bottle cages that hold onto bottles very, very well. But I think it's one of those like mental games where you think, well, if I don't change out my bottle cages and I lose my bottle, I'm going to be absolutely raging. So I'm just going to do this. It's going to give me that peace of mind. And like, you know, you don't want to lose your bottle because, you know, obviously in a kind of the midst of a race like that, it can be so hard to grab a bottle from a feed zone because everyone's trying to do it. You know, you can't do it on our cobbled sector. So every time the race hits tarmac, I imagine everyone is desperate to get over to the side of the road to grab some food or a bottle from one of their kind of, you know, soigneurs or kind of, you know, team assistants. Grabbing a bottle is such a hard skill.
Grabbing a bottle in a UK race that's doing like 40k, which is hard enough, but you come off cobbles and your hands are numb and you're doing 50 something
and you're knackered.
And you're trying to grab a bottle.
So you don't want to be losing the ones that you've, you know, that you've already got. So I think, yeah, so wherever, you know, I've got a set of, you know, Tax Zero bottle cages on my gravel bike and they are really, really good at holding bottles. But I can see why people go for the kind of tried and tested ones that just give you that extra, even if it's just a kind of mental peace of mind.
Well, we can wrap up there. I'm going to put you on the spot, Liam. We've talked through a lot of tech in this half an hour podcast, but what was your number one tech highlight or tech takeaway from this year's race?
Oh, you can go very, very fast running very big tyres at very low pressures. And I think realistically, for those of us that ride on our local roads, it's not horrific around here in the Southwest, but it's bad enough. You can run big tyres and be comfy and have cornering grip and go perfectly fast enough. You don't have to run tiny tyres to go fast.
And Simon, how about you?
So I saw a report that Matthew van der Poel started on a bike with smaller tyres and then switched to a bike with bigger tyres kind of, you know, before the first cobbled sector. And I, you know, that's something that as an amateur fills me with dread because you think, well, what if I can't stop and then I have to ride the race on, you know, the kind of the unoptimized bike. So my Hannah highlight is Matthew van der Poel's confidence that as the world champion, he knew that he could just stop the peloton to take a wee, swap bikes, get back on. And, you know, that advantage of, you know, riding the bike with narrow tyres, presumably he felt it was a kind of aerodynamic advantage that the kind of narrow tyres would be slightly better with the rims that he had on his bike. Are kind of like, yeah, I really appreciate that confidence that he knew that he was going to be able to take a break, get off the bike, swap it over, and then, you know, crush the race.
I'm sorry, I can't take Simon's answer. His tech highlight is the grippy bar tape, and he wants some.
We'll be getting some in, especially for you, Simon, if it gives you the heebie-jeebies, as you say. I think Mathieu van der Poel did that last year. I think he started on 30s and then switched to 32s before the first sector. Well, plenty of confidence from Mathieu van der Poel, and rightly so, because it has been the Mathieu van der Poel show over the past week at Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. We can leave it there. This has been a whistle-stop tour of the tech highlights on this Monday morning after Paris-Roubaix. Liam, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And Simon, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Always a pleasure.
We've got plenty more coverage coming this week from Paris-Roubaix. You can check out the site where we'll have a full tech gallery, where we will show you a lot of the things that we've spoken about in this podcast, and also head over to our YouTube channel. We've got a full video coming with Liam's Paris-Roubaix tech highlights. Again, a lot of the things we've spoken about today in more detail from Liam, so do go and see that. Make sure you leave us a rating and review on your podcast provider of choice. Otherwise, we will speak to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.